You are listening to the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast, episode 272, A Magic Leap Off the Wrist.
Episode 272 of the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast. Today is December the 11th, 2016. I'm Matthew Dean Furlough, and being the first American to orbit Earth is my brother, James Furlough.
Yeah, that's right. John Glenn, huh? Done for.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He made his last revolution around the sun. Whatever. Yeah, it was a bummer.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing to, hearing some of the, biographies and stuff about the dude. And it's like multi-time senator, which is a pretty big deal just in and of itself, and a major war hero flying tons and tons of different, missions. Actually, one of his last missions, he got into a dogfight and took down 3 Soviet MiGs. And the question was, what was scarier, that dogfight or being the first American to orbit the Earth?
Yeah, he's seen some things, that's for sure.
Right.
Was he any good as a senator? I don't even know.
He was a multi-turn senator, so I'm assuming he was good enough.
Okay.
it kept voting him back in.
Yeah, I feel like he kind of like that was a gimme, but
it took him 3 tries to win.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, it was a bit of a struggle, and but that's pretty amazing, dude. And basically set off a giant explosion and exploded him into space.
Speaking of dogfighting in space.
Yes.
Got your tickets for Friday?
Yeah. I'm ready. I'm all geared up. We're doing the IMAX deal.
Nice.
Glad getting into it. So for those of you who have no idea what we're talking about, obviously Star Wars.
Dude, they know exactly what we're talking about.
Which are you all geared up?
I am, yep, and I even managed to pull another family in with us, so it will be a blast with blasters. Yeah, it's gonna be super fun. I'm excited for it. We got a babysitter, it's all lined up.
Oh man. I hope it's good. They aren't removing the review embargo until whatever that day is, or like Wednesday.
Really?
Man, yeah, it might be Tuesday, but it's like you're reading tea leaves when you're trying to figure out like what it means by when they end the embargo on movies. But it's generally speaking, it is a bad sign when they wait till the very end to open up the embargoes, unless there's a really surprising twist in the movie, in which case I'm ruining this because I'm revealing it to you all. But then the reason why they do that is because they're like, no, we don't want anything to get out, and the embargo is they're like, don't worry, there'll be word of mouth. People know this movie's coming. It's fine. We don't have to worry. We're better off like holding back and letting people be pleasantly surprised by things that they didn't see coming, as opposed to getting reviews out there like crazy early on. And
I wonder, I get that sense like with episode 7, they like pretty much did everything. You know, like,
right,
here's everything about the movie except for, you know, obviously near the ending there. And that managed, at least I wasn't actively trying to find out information, so I didn't find out about it. But I don't know, maybe this one they're trying something a little different. And like you said, right, it's, you can almost, you could do too much. Like, I feel like for episode 7, it was appropriate for it to just be like, to everyone was like, the Disney machine is running.
Right.
You know? And this one, it feels less that way. Mm-hmm. And there's a part of me that's like, I wonder if that feels that it's on purpose. Yeah, they're trying to keep that main line like something special and unique and interesting. Well,
I know that the advertising campaign for the Avengers movies is way different than it is for the individual movies. And I think that that is, that's incredibly intentional because like you said, it keeps the giant movies special, even though from like a budget perspective and how much money they make, they're not really that storyline. Yeah. But they're these completely, you know, yet the marketing campaign and how they, you know, how much they put it in your face and how early they go about releasing reviews and stuff, completely different. And
it's probably one of those, it's like you said, from an actual product standpoint, it costs the exact same amount, except for the marketing and sales side of it, where like with the Avengers, they expect more people to go watch it to make more money. Therefore, they're willing to spend more money on the marketing, and therefore it seems bigger.
Yeah, this is a super rough rule of thumb, but the rule of thumb is generally that the whatever they spend on the movie, you double that. That's what they spend on marketing and advertising. And so if it's which can be a pretty big difference. I don't know. It's interesting stuff. Definitely, we're talking about. But we will probably talk about it more next week, I suppose. Instead, this week we'll talk about what we talk about every week, which is technology and the continuing corporate opera. And by that, we mean the soap opera of corporations dealing back and forth, the people working for them, their marketing campaigns, and of course, the technology they're developing. But before we get into the heart of the show, James got a short disclosure he's got to throw our way.
Yeah, I founded HPI, and I work for them. However, I do not represent them or any of their opinions.
Nice. Just throwing it out there. If you want to follow us throughout the week, and we'll put pictures on Instagram and tweet stuff. Not as much as I should, but I do. My Twitter is at Matthew D. Furlow, and my Instagram is nexttowiggin4. If you want to contact us ever, me in particular, that's a great way to do it. But if you want to contact James,
Let's see, Twitter is probably the easiest. And that's, I have people reach out to me on Twitter, on Facebook, on LinkedIn, and it's James Furlow on all of them.
All over the place. Nice. Also, if you want to know more about everything we talk about on the show today, any of the articles, clicks, links, whatever, videos, that sort of thing, it's all going to be at furloughbros.com. If we do any giveaways, it'll be at furloughbros.com. If we,
you mean like this week?
Yeah. Yes, specifically. Okay. Anytime we give things away like we're giving them away this week.
So we've kind of buried this one, but yeah, we're doing a giveaway. So Matthew has looked at and reviewed the Google Home, and now we're giving it away. So if you go to multiple places, furloughbros.com/272, you'll see a big link there that says furloughbros giveaway. Mm-hmm. You can also just go to straight furloughbros.com/giveaways/Google Home, and you can check it out. But yeah, we're doing a giveaway.
Yeah. You
get it. It's yours free.
Yeah. It's awesome. And I was overly meticulous to make sure that this thing is in crisp condition. You can't even tell that it was open, except for the tape's gone. But I was really careful about removing the tape so that it looks good.
Awesome.
But, yeah. It's good. Good stuff.
I guess we'll just jump right into this, huh?
Yes.
Okay. Let's do it. All right. I want to open it up with an easy one. It's by The Guardian, and it's called Rocket Men, Why Tech's Biggest Billionaires Want Their Place in Space. I don't know if you know that, but there's a couple billionaires who want to go to space. I don't know if that was...
They're jealous of John Glenn.
I know, right? We're just keeping that theme going, I guess. Yeah, super, super interesting that there's a lot of billionaires that are interested in space. Elon Musk is one you may or may not have heard of. let's see here, Jeff Bezos, when he's not making stores, he's making rocket ships, because that's how he rolls. Which is not him, I get it. But anyways, he's funding things. But they're not the only ones. Richard Branson with Virgin, what is it? It's not Virgin Atlantic.
Galactic.
Galactic. There we go. I'm like, that sounds familiar, but that's not right.
Yeah.
So he's one. And then Paul Allen is the other guy who has Spaceship 1, 2, 3, 1, 2. And then finally, there's the fifth one. The crazy Russian entrepreneur Yuri Milner, who, by the way, is named after Yuri Gagarin, who was the first man in space.
Huh.
How about that for kind of sweet? And yeah, so they're all doing different things. So we've talked a lot about SpaceX and Musk and how he thinks that the world's going to die and therefore we need to go to Mars and interplanetary living is the only way to live, in his opinion. And so that's what he's doing. And as we talked about, things like Tesla and SolarCity are designed to give us more time to get to Mars, because he's concerned about that, and to fund trips to Mars, ultimately. And so that's his thing, and that's why he wants to go. Jeff Bezos, he has a very different reason. He views space today like, I would probably say, like almost like the electricity wars between Edison and Tesla, where it's like it's the foundational steps to what will eventually lead to something the equivalent of the internet.
Okay.
Yeah, right? You're just like, all right, let me wrap my head around that.
Yeah.
And so his whole thing is like, he doesn't necessarily want to go to Mars outside of that's cool. And he's even gone as far as to say, because we've looked, we have photos, we've had satellites go around our galaxy, right? I always got to get the size right.
Just the solar system.
Solar system. There we go. I'm like, see, there's a universe, there's galaxies, solar systems. It's big out there. Anyways, he goes, we've looked all around. He's like, Earth is awesome. It's the best of all the worlds. Like, we should try to stay here and instead move things that are hurting the Earth off of it. So, for example, he wants all manufacturing to be done in space.
All right. I like that.
And that's where he sees it as, if we can figure out how to do that, if we can mine other planets for raw materials, process them and combine them in space before shipping them back home to Earth. I mean, like, talk about outsourcing.
Right, yeah.
He goes, that would be better. And that would, again, help preserve Earth, because we'd be adding things to it, not taking away from it.
And that's honestly not as crazy. Like, that might sound really, really laborious and crazy, but it's not necessarily, because it's like, one thing we know about asteroids is they tend to be very resource rich. They have a lot of rare metals in them. And you might be thinking, well, how do we get them back to Earth? Well, it's really easy. They're already just floating out there. Like, there's no gravity fighting against you. So if you can get a robot out there that just drills and then kind of chucks it back at Earth with a little bit of propellant, then boom, you're on your way. And it's actually would be relatively energy not very energy intensive, unintensive. And to get stuff back to Earth, and not to mention the fact that there are stuff out in the solar system that is incredibly rare on Earth and valuable. For example, helium-3 or trillium, trihelium. It's an isotope of helium that is insanely rare on Earth and very common on the moon's surface, and it is really, really advantageous when doing fusion experiments and trying to get a sustainable fusion reaction. And one of the big things that they talk about when they talk about fusion reactors is if it's possible to build a, you know, if we ever figure out how to build a fusion reactor, a sustainable one that can act as a power source, the best thing for us to do would be to power it using this isotope of helium, H3, and really only going to be able to get it on the moon. So there are huge implications for being able to manufacture and mine outside of Earth.
Hmm. Yeah, totally makes sense. Totally makes sense. And so he doesn't necessarily see Amazon as being that company that ultimately does that, but being a company that gets it closer to being done. And he talks about he expects other startups and entrepreneurs to literally build on top of his rockets in the same way that people have built off of previous infrastructure to get ultimately the internet. And that's his... yeah, that's his thing.
Okay. I can buy it. It's pretty good.
Yeah, yeah. It talks a little bit about Richard Branson as well. And they're just like, he just likes space. I don't know.
he's rich and weird.
It's funny, one of the premier or well-respected head of NASA kind of guys went around and... spend a lot of time with each of these different guys, just kind of letting them pick his brain type of stuff. And essentially, he came back from Richard Branson and was like, he has stars in his eyes. He's just like pumped about it.
That's awesome.
He wants to take people up. You know, he thinks that it's, his is really more about like space is cool. It's not about productivity. It's not about expanding our world, if you will.
Right.
Which I don't know. We'll see how that works out for him. Which I guess it's both. Okay. So it's Paul Allen and Richard Branson are working together. Sorry. I thought they were separate at first. But no, they're working together. They're the ones who are doing Spaceship 2 at the moment. And they've got people signed up like Tom Hanks, Ashton Kutcher, Leonardo DiCaprio. They all paid about $250,000 to do their little suborbital fly around the world, John Glenn style.
That's enough
stuff. Yeah, dude. How about that? And then I thought this was cool. Like Yuri Milner, he's
the one doing the postage stamp stuff, right? He's trying to get to another solar system.
Yes. Yes. They didn't describe it this way, but he's invested $100 million, which where did he get his money from? I don't know. I was a little dubious. I probably should figure that out. Anyways, they're researching lasers to fling tiny robots towards the stars at 1/5 the speed of light.
Right.
That's, yeah. So tiny robots.
Yeah. Yeah. Little
space.
Yep, and they're going to use giant laser arrays to...
Yep. Yep. We'll see how that goes. It's pretty interesting. And then it goes on to talk about how often there's more hype than reality with these guys. They're trying to assess, like, is this just ego? Or, like, what's going on with this? And they're just like... No, they see an opportunity and they have the funds, and a part of it is that childhood dream of space. And they grew up in a time when people like John Glenn were doing what they were doing, going out in the space, and they expected, like, all right, we've gone around the world. Sweet. We've gone to the moon. Sweet. Now we're going to Mars and we're building bigger ships. And it was like, or not. Maybe we'll send unmanned satellites. Maybe we'll build the International Space Station. And
it's very interesting that it's made more aware of this week. The idea that it's one of those things where, like, I kind of knew, but
I guess maybe I'd forgotten or never really understood, but this idea that these astronauts were superstars, and they were larger than life. They were like the heroes of children and adults alike, you know, because they were doing these incredibly dangerous, perceived to be incredibly dangerous, difficult things, and they were going to go into the next frontier, you know,
there's a movie on Netflix, let me put it that way, that kind of traumatizes that phase in history. And I mean, it's all actors that we all know and love, but playing these, Buzz Aldrin and I think he was a little bit later, but it was John Glenn, Andrew Shepherd, and some other, you know, some of the Gemini product, you know, Gemini guys. Yeah. And it follows them around, and it's interesting, yeah, because they are definitely like anywhere they go, they are superstars. And you know, it's just absolutely crazy.
Correct?
Maybe. Is that a really
1983 American epic historical drama film that was adapted from Tom Wolfe's best-selling 1979 book of the same name.
That's definitely it. Ed Harris is in it. Yeah, it's good. Yeah. That's the stuff. The right stuff. It's on Netflix. It's, or at least it was. It's really kind of like, oh boy. but it's funny. At one point in time, they're like, there are these pilots. It's fun to watch them go all through the testing, and they're testing their endurance and whatever. But at the end of the day, they're like, you're just in a tin can hurling through space, just like along for the ride. And these are all like test pilots, right? And they had to fight just to get a window into the capsule. And
so they could actually see it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause at first they were like, no, you're not, you're literally just riding along. Like, so we can say we put a human in space. It's pretty interesting, but yeah, part of the movie is like, they're all stars and, American legends, you know, and people want to interview them and ask them questions. And it's like the first one to go up, huge deal. Of course, then it's funny. Like after they go up like three times, then it's kind of like, okay, cool, done. You know?
We had such an emphasis on making it, you know, never losing an American in space. That was such a high-minded goal of NASA, because it really separated the Soviet program from the American program, that NASA never lost an astronaut in space. That they made it so safe, it almost, like, the allure of the danger and just the breathtaking nature of the projects weren't scary because people didn't die. and you're like, it almost, it's this weird, it kind of took the superstar nature aspect away from it in some way, because it wasn't this, they were just, all of a sudden they were just nerds. And you're like, yeah, but they were incredibly physically fit, incredibly smart, just, you know, peak humanity sort of people. I don't know. It's an interesting, it's interesting to watch America's fascination with astronauts rise and fall. And they're still impressive, but they're not near, it's not like it once was at that moment.
It's all these guys, these billionaires, right, grew up with that.
That's what I was going to say. That's the point, is that they were all children when these guys were superstars. They were giants. They weren't, you know, it's like they have this memory of...
Holy cow, the next wave of billionaires are going to be in the football. This is bad.
But it's, you know, yeah, but yeah, I don't know. It is interesting. It's an interesting development.
Oh. Yeah, yeah. It's cool. Hey, you know, at the end of the article, they're like, you know what? If they're doing it for selfish reasons or whatever, like either way, we're going to space. It's all good.
Yeah, I can abide this. You know who's not going to be sending us to space, though? Which CEO is going to fail doing that?
No, which one?
His name is Ronnie Abovitz, and he is the CEO.
You're watching too many Gilmore Girls. Is that it, Rory?
Yeah, all right.
It's the same. I know that.
If you hadn't said it, I wouldn't have remembered. But yeah, no. So Ronnie Hor or Abramovitz, not jeez, he.
I like Ronnie Hor. That's pretty good.
Yeah. He's the CEO of Magic Leap, and Magic Leap is a company that we've talked about on and off again. They have this really cool technology that can project light into your eyes. They've had these demo videos that they've shown off that are like that it's where the whole idea is you put on this headset and then like your eyes can't tell the difference between what you're seeing and like what is being projected into your eyes by the headset and what's coming through just the rest of the world. And they were talking about how they actually had to like, it was freaking people out. And so they had to adjust the settings to kind of give the fake images a glow so that you kind of knew the difference between them. And it sounded amazing. They've raised $1.4 billion.
Wow.
A lot of money. They have investors include Google, Chinese e-commerce giant Alibaba, Silicon Valley juggernaut Andreessen Horowitz. I keep coming back to the fact that if you've been listening to the show long enough, you know, I think this is a dumb company. I don't know how they get their money. I don't know what's going on. I just had this feeling that it all sounded like talk and just, you never actually got a demo. People didn't show it on stage. They were talking about and showing these like demo teaser videos, but never really came through on the promise of what it's capable of. Turns out the original demo video that got people really, really excited, where they were like, they're playing a game in an office building, complete CGI, just completely fake. Like it was an idealized, like it wasn't shot on demo equipment. It was, they got like a really high resolution camera, and then they literally had Weta, the guys who did Lord of the Rings, do the animation for it.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, and originally they had claimed that Weta was involved just supplying the 3D models that then were projected onto it, but that's not true. They just completely did it. This like cool eye projection technology. I guess it actually is pretty neat, and we've kind of talked about like people finally figured out what it was because they weren't telling anybody what it was they were building except for these investors. Wired did an article earlier this year, and they talked about how the technology works and kind of what it is and why it's different than what like what Microsoft is doing with the HoloLens, correct? And the HoloLens, because it's a similar type of technology where you're looking around the real world, but there's extra images being put on top of it. And I guess the problem was that although like Magic Leap's technology, it directly projected the light into your eyes. Your eyes couldn't tell the difference. And it like, and the big trick was it was all about how your eyes focus. It deals with focus better than Microsoft's technology, which sounds pretty cool and pretty interesting if you could get that working. The problem is
yeah.
the one actual working prototype that they have is this giant headset that's not mobile at all.
Sweet.
And they have not at all been able to figure out how to miniaturize it. So now it's just using, it sounds like it's, they're like the only way that they're going to come up with a shippable product is to build it literally the same thing that Microsoft is doing. So it has no advantage over it, except it doesn't have all of the software and engineering prowess that comes along with being Microsoft. And you just like, it's pretty amazing. Especially since you can buy Microsoft's prototype, their HoloLens, now for $3,000. I mean, it's expensive, but you can buy it, the developer kit, and start working on it.
Well, the best part is that one that you can buy is already one or two generations old compared to what's inside of Microsoft's labs.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and it's
that just, was the one that they felt comfortable, like, everything's working on it, we can sell it.
Yep, yeah. Yeah, and it just, it's,
wow, I'm not surprised at all, but it's kind of nice to hear it, too.
I was going to say, yeah, finally, it's like, it finally feels like we're getting to the truth of the situation where this company is just a total disaster, and that they're really good at selling investors. It sounds like that's their real talent, is getting investors to give them enormous piles of cash. And the only thing that I can think is that they legitimately had something really neat, and Microsoft had been kind of keeping... Microsoft had done a very good job of keeping their HoloLens stuff quiet, and it allowed Magic Leap to get some serious investors, because they were like, oh, we got all sorts of things that are going to make this awesome. And there was nobody else that was trying to do the mixed reality scanning the rest of the world and doing all sorts of inside out tracking and stuff. And because that's the funniest part about this to me, is that like the actual projection equipment on Microsoft's HoloLens is super easy to understand. They're just refracting light through an opaque or through a translucent screen. It's standard technology. They've been using it anywhere where you get heads-up displays. They've been using this type of technology forever. It's not that impressive for how the image technology works, but that means that it's really easy to build because the technology's there and has been there for a long time. What Microsoft has really been revolutionizing is how do you do motion tracking? How do you, where they just have a couple of cameras on the headset and all the motion tracking is done internally. It's a really big deal that nobody else has been able to ship a product of that quality for. It's huge. They're making custom silicon chips to do hardware acceleration on it. Like, there's all sorts of nutty stuff that Microsoft is doing on that end. Not to mention the fact that they're building their whole Windows holographic, which is this entire operating system built around this type of interface. And Magic Leap not only is not doing motion tracking, they don't have an operating system. They're not trying to work with Microsoft's operating system. And they can't even get their projection lenses working. They're like sophisticated, cool stuff. I just look at this company, I'm like, man, they got so much money from these giant companies and they're going to just fall so short of ever being anything. I'm starting to get to the point where I'm like, I'd be willing to put with the proper odds, I would be willing to put money on the idea that they never ship a product.
Wow.
And I'm like, I'd go like 4-1. Like, that's, I think they've got so much money and there's so much pressure, they have to ship something, even if it's pathetic. But just my gut on this company is that they're so pathetic, they'll never even ship a product. Their investors are going to come in and say, look, we want our money back. You guys are just the worst.
There's got to be, as an investor, like, I don't know. It's either like they're actively having conversations about this and it's like, well, they've got my money and there's nothing I can do about it, but you're not getting any more type of thing.
Yeah.
And they're just shaking their heads when these articles come out. But they're also not going to say anything because they might get lucky, you know?
Right, yeah.
And they themselves don't want to be like, oh, yeah, we made a better investment. It, you know, they're going to distance themselves, right, and hope that they're never actually mentioned as an investor anymore. And, you know, that could be one thing. Or it genuinely is like, I always seen the product, it's good. This information doesn't know what they're talking about, and they've got enough money, we're not going to worry about it. You know? Let Microsoft think it has no problem. It's possible.
Yeah, that's possible. It's also possible that I could orbit the Earth tonight, but it seems unlikely.
My guess is, at the time, like you said, he's great at selling the dream and hyping things up. He probably had little bits and pieces of demos that got people excited, and it was all before the HoloLens came out.
Right.
And my guess is that if he went out and tried to raise that money today, it would be a very different story.
Right. Well, and I think at the time, Google hadn't even come out with Cardboard yet when they were starting to, when they made their investment in Magic Leap, if I remember correctly, or it was like right around the same time, which Cardboard was as soft a first step as a company could possibly take. They literally said, hey, here's some cardboard. turn it into a VR headset. One of their employees invented it, and they were like, and the company was like, hey, this is kind of neat. We might build a little more software and support this kind of, and you know, now it's turning into a full featured part of their new platform. We're going to do VR. Right. You know, Facebook bought Oculus. So Oculus is now part of Facebook. And this is all prior to these giant companies.
See, really, I think they hit it right when there was a bunch of excitement and people knew about the potential. Right. And so they're willing to put money behind it.
Yeah.
And
I think
that that's what it is everybody was looking at Oculus and said, you know, Oculus has a little bit of potential, but I don't really see anything outside of video games. Whereas Magic Leap had huge potential in
which
the way
is what we've always said, like AR is right. The future VR right. Is just kind of, it's a halfway stop,
yeah, and it will have advantages, but it'll always be a smaller niche, and I think that that's what everybody thought, and that's why they put so much money into it, and now they're kind of taking a step back and thinking, yeah, no. I'm excited about it because it's always felt like garbage to me. From the very beginning, I'm glad we're starting to get other information. And the best part about it is the CEO has been read the article and has been started tweeting and whatnot. And he's just like, it's, you know, to a few of the grumpy mouse tech blogger writers.
That'd be you.
You too, yeah, I know. You too will get to play the real thing when we ship. Yeah, I'm sure. When you ship, whenever that is. For our launch, everyone, skeptics and friends alike, will be able to try Magic Leap for themselves. Which it just sounds like the sort of thing you say, like, you're trying to be confident.
When in the process of losing a game?
Yeah, exactly. No. I know it's the third quarter, but we're the best, you know, this is how it felt watching the Warriors last night. It was like, I know that we're super behind and been behind this entire game, but we're the Warriors, so we're going to do awesome. And then you lose anyways, because you make me sad. they're doing good. I feel bad comparing the Warriors to Magic Leap at this point.
Yeah, that's an unfair comparison. For sure.
I can say, in both directions. Gives Magic Leap too much credit and Warriors not enough.
Yeah, because at least with the Warriors, you're like, historically, they've won. So
yes, exactly. They've ever done something worth commenting on other than raising a bunch of money.
They have come from behind like this and won. So
yeah, exactly.
I'm with you. It's interesting how it's just not normal for CEOs with only the vision to you just don't hear about this kind of stuff because they never get this big.
Yeah,
I guess is what I'm trying to say.
I can say I'm, you know, me being mean right now. Like I know people like this, and I guess that's why this. I guess that's why like it just feels so. Like,
yeah,
like
I mean, I don't want to rag. You know what? You rag on my business, so I'm going to rag on your friends. So take this. The whole because I've had more time to think about it, but we did an interview too. You got your friends where they were like, you know, check out these couches or furniture and, you know, find the things that are hard to find and to decorate your room with, again, like good pieces of furniture, not IKEA pieces of furniture. And I'm like, and on one level, you're like, yeah, that's cool. You know, I like it. But you almost got a sense they were like, we're changing the nature of shopping right now. Like the way you shop for furniture will never be the same once we come out with this. And you're like, okay. Like,
yeah, it's funny.
The ultimate thing was a few compromises on that ultimate dream and vision.
Right.
And, you know, part of it's people playing ball, whatever. Like there's always reasons why, oh, well, we couldn't figure out that part of the technology. We couldn't get those partnerships in place, right? Apple TV, and I mean it happens, and but it's that same, like you hear that same resolve and dream and vision with the startups, and I mean that's what this guy is. He just happens to have $1.5 billion behind his comments, and everyone's kind of shaking their heads, going, "What in the world did he say in those meetings to get those types of checks. And how do I say that?
I think that's the trick. I think it was all about timing, and I think the timing was a giant part of it, and the fact that he got Alibaba and Google and Mark Andreessen, like the three of them. It's one of those classic. There was a movie that was made where they have well over 100 cameos from really like big actors and actresses, and it's a horrible movie. Everybody is embarrassed to be a part of.
You're not like, talking about like Anchorman, are you?
No. I can't even remember the name of this movie. But it's just like it's like unsettlingly. Like it's meant to be unsettling, because what the writer directors like realized that they could do was they got like they had a friend and they were like, hey, can you make a cameo in our movie? And the guy was like, yeah, I guess, just like give it a little like star power. Well, then they went to other friends who were like, hey, this guy's in the movie.
Yeah,
they started just to leverage everybody else, and so it wasn't until the movie was over that and it had hundreds of cameos, so it like gave it all this weight, and then people watched it and were like, this isn't just like a poorly made movie. This is like a bad message. This is like bad for my image. Like it just is like a and I when you look at that's what I feel like happened here was Andreessen and Paige and these guys all showed up and they're like, well, Andreessen gave a bunch of money.
Who knows? He might have been excellent at playing them all off, right?
Exactly. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That's what I think happened was it was obvious that he had a demo that could show them what the rest of everybody else now knows, like a year before everybody else, and got a ton of money and never turned it into a shippable product. Because turns out Microsoft was already way ahead of them. They just hadn't told anybody yet.
And it turns out that making hardware is tough.
Really hard, yeah.
Yeah. You can ask all sorts of companies about this, but some would argue, like this guy in the New York Times, whatever that is, that... we're entering into a winter of gadgets. And I'll be honest, I don't totally agree with this, but we're going to go with it anyways for now, and then I'll tell you why he's wrong. He's like, if you look around you, you've got companies like, we'll use Magic Leap, unable to ship, which, again, there may be some other issues involved. But, Magic Leap. Another one we're going to talk a little bit more about, Pebble, is no more. Fitbit.
Having struggles, yeah.
Their own set of issues. GoPros can't seem to get off the ground lately. even Jawbone has... I know, it's not fair. They make it too easy. Jawbone is struggling. Nest, we've talked a little bit about Nest and their issues, despite having a very friendly parent. Just gadgets seem to be struggling. When... you think about, more than a few years back, like the thing to have were like transistor radios or the TRS-80s or the Walkman and the Game Boy and the iPods and the flips. And you remember the flip?
Yeah.
It was like, I remember I was on a Mexico mission trip and I was talking, he was a sports reporter for the newspaper where I live, and he had a flip. He's like, man, it's awesome. I can record videos and do all this stuff and export it right to it. It's like, and it's high quality. It's great. And I pulled up my phone and went, me too. And he's like, no. This one's nice because it's dedicated. I'm like, oh, okay. Well, this one's nice because I can replay it and edit it and share it.
Yeah, but, right.
Yeah, whatever.
On the device.
That's cool, man. He's like, well, I've got a big battery and a lot of memory. I'm like, okay, I guess you got me there. Mine only lasts a day and I only, but
yeah,
which is tends to be good enough cause I can charge it. How long do your games go for again? He doesn't have a flip anymore. He uses an iPhone for literally everything. It's pretty funny. So, but that's the point. Right, is I think that's like an awesome example of what this guy talks about, because he goes into like, well, what happened? And because he said like it's an interesting story where essentially, like, international manufacturing happened. And I actually happened a few years back, which is what proliferated all of these gadgets, because all of a sudden it became, for the most part, affordable. And, you know, over time, two things happened, really.
Yeah.
The first one was, the gadget, as he likes to call it, happened. You know, it's it was, you know, that thing that does everything emerged from Cupertino.
Yeah.
And so there's that, and we have a classic picture that we took. We were Jesse and I took that where we were cleaning out the garage, and Jesse literally had like a handful of gadgets. It was her alarm clock, her calculator. She had a flashlight. She had I'm trying to remember. There was something. She had like four. She had like five or six, not just four. Like five or six, like different things in her hand, and she was like, "Yeah, I literally don't need any of this anymore." And you know, and this was like back on like 3G days, and there was enough to recognize. Oh yeah, these things aren't done, or they're not needed. Anyway, it's just absolutely crazy the amount of replacement that's happened with that. And so that happened. Obviously, there's a bunch of consolidation on that end. And then he goes in to say, like, because of this contract manufacturing, things became cheaper to produce, and you would literally have companies who would make knockoffs. Like, for him, he was taking a trip to Hawaii, and he's like, you know, it'd be kind of fun would be to have a GoPro with me to take photos and videos of stuff. Which, right. When I went to Indonesia, the host that we were with, he had a GoPro, and he took pictures of us snorkeling, and I mean, I looked at it and went, that's pretty awesome. If you're doing anything water related, GoPro is the way to go. But he started looking online. He's like, all right, well, what do we got out there, because, you know, whatever. And he ended up buying some knockoff thing that did the exact same things as a GoPro, but cost half the price.
Yeah.
And he goes, yeah, it wasn't as great, the software wasn't as good. But he's like, I'm not a sports guy. I do Twitter and I take vacations. And for that, perfect. Good enough. You know, right? They're coming out with these gadgets that are, quote, good enough. And so he's talking about how it just, yeah, we're coming into a phase where gadgets are less of a thing. Which, again, that's where I kind of come back and, like, I don't know if I agree with that statement. Because I feel like there was... As opposed to now being a winter, I feel like there was a very short window of a golden age, maybe is the way to say it, where like you had things like Kickstarter pop up where all of a sudden, boom, we're going to make a pebble for you. We're going to make a smart cooler. We're going to do all this crazy stuff. And part of it's the market just figuring out, right? Like what can we do? What can't we do? And ultimately things that are successful, like the pebble, you get big companies that come in and go, oh, we want a piece of that pie. And they have the R&D and the manufacturing and the expertise to just, quote, do it better. And it's funny, like, there's a part of me, like, he talks about the Sony Walkman. Like, you do know, like, Sony's not some startup company, right?
Right.
Like, they are not teensy. And he just, like...
Yeah.
It's always been the case.
Yeah, and at the advent of the Sony Walkman, they already cut the Sony transistor line of radios. I mean, Sony was an enormous, hyper successful company in so many ways. And by the time the Walkman came around, and it just
Now he does go on to say there's a lot of tech companies that hardware is a sideshow for them. Amazon is a great example, right? Their Kindle and their Echo. It's like, they're not dependent on that at all. Google, they got their Pixel, their Home, the Nest. They're like, they're not dependent on that. Snap, right? They're not dependent on spectacles. there's probably a handful of companies, Samsung, Sony, Apple, HP actually falls into this category, that are dependent on hardware still. And I'm sure the more I think about it, the more it's like, dude, it is 50-50. We just, like, you just don't hear, like, Facebook, okay, Yeah, I guess Oculus is a sideshow thing.
It's such a, I don't know, it's interesting. It's always fascinating to me. Like, and I think one of the big differences is it kind of depends on what you're into. Because all of the giant Asian brands that we're aware of are hardware manufacturers.
Right.
You know, Panasonic, Sony, Samsung, we can keep going. I'm sure I can come up with others. Asus, you know, like
Lenovo.
Thank you, Lenovo. Yeah, you know, there are giant hardware companies, but they all kind of build similar stuff. They build general purpose computers, whether they're laptops, desktops, phones, stuff like that. That's kind of where we think of them. And the thing about what we're actually seeing, if I had to say, what we're actually seeing is the end, not of gadgets, but the end of like single purpose or hyper purposeful devices. And the only way to take another step forward is to say, all right, there are limitations to what GPUs can, or what CPUs can handle. Is this like, if you, maybe this is the wrong way to break it down, but to me, it's like, the CPU is this amazing thing that is really power hungry, very large, takes a lot of like support equipment, or did for a very long time. One of the reasons why the Sony Walkman existed and the Sony CD player, you know, like all these different versions of these devices, they were all built on simpler microprocessors as opposed to a full-blown general purpose CPU. And it wasn't until you got the CPU small enough where it was a general purpose CPU with a dedicated GPU core that you got the iPhone that was this like that had this tipping point. And especially in the realm of gadgets. So the next step to me is it's like, well, okay, what can you do with where a smartphone isn't really like, it's not enough. A general purpose computer isn't enough. And the two obvious areas are going to be things like drones, which are highly sophisticated mechanical equipment. And that's a gadget department that's doing gangbusters right now. And as dumb as it always sounds, but the whole Internet of Things thing, the advantage there, or the problem there that you're trying to solve, is that you have one phone. What if I need my phone to be in eight different places? Well, what if we build really like really low powered system on a chip, general purpose CPUs, and put them in everything. And those are the sorts of gadgets that we're buying. I get the feeling that the type of gadget is changing, not the quantity or the quality. It's just.
Well, yeah, it was like that. We were reading that Andreessen article. I think that was Thanksgiving week. And his point was, he was like, we like to think there's only like two or three computer companies in the world. And you know, you think it's Microsoft and Apple are the only two operating systems, and then there's a handful of hardware manufacturers, like, you know, again, HP, Lenovo, Samsung, guys like that. He's like, no, there are a ton of computer companies. Some of them happen to fly. We call them drones. Some of them happen to be on your locks. Some of them happen to, they take all these different shapes and sizes. They all have their own different operating systems. They're all computers. These are computer companies.
They all, quote unquote, have their own operating system. And by that, they mean Linux, Unix, Ubuntu, like some variation of Linux. There are incredibly rare and generally unsuccessful companies that build their own operating system. Most of these, you know, but the thing is,
I mean, if you even think about like Apple, right? It's built on Linux and
Unix. It's got the Unix. It's got the same core stuff, so you can do a lot of the dev that you can do on your Mac very easily translates over to Ubuntu. And so, the trick there is, like, we come back. It's not that these things are going away; they're just changing. And to be like, oh my gosh, gadgets are done. It just drives me nuts. It's can you put enough processing power into these smaller form factors? That really is where question. And that's my question, James. Can you put enough processing power into these smaller packages to make them successful on your wrist?
You know, that's interesting. there's a part of me that, because yeah, Pebble is Dunsky's, but a lot of the argument is like smartwatches are not the next big thing, which like they were never promised to be the next big thing, but they're even saying like there's initial demand spike and now it's tailing off, and it's like it's an even faster and more extreme spike than what happened with the iPad, right? Because that was kind of the thought, is Apple did the iPhone came out and you know it just it grew and now we're just finally starting to see it tail off and mature. The iPad grew crazy fast relative even to the iPhone, and then tailed off and is now in decline. And they're saying like the watch was even a faster spike, which I'm like, dude, you only have so much money. I mean, like, come on.
Yeah.
So you have to make choices. But, and so they're seeing that same thing, right? There was a spike and now there's a tail off, and they're just saying people just aren't that into it, which me as someone who bought the recent one, I don't want to hear that.
You know what? They're so wrong. They're so wrong.
Okay,
they're
I feel so like wrong. Are you sure you're not as biased as I am in this situation?
I am sure of my biases, okay? I have been an advocate for the wrist-borne computer since well before Apple ever launched their watch. I mean, like this has been a constant for me since, I'm guessing, late season three. I've been an advocate for some form of a watch, for those of you not paying attention. That's like 2.5 years ago. Like, I just, when the Apple Watch was coming out, I couldn't do a show without talking about the Apple Watch for like a half hour. Like,
VR.
Exactly. I was into it, and I've worn mine every day since I bought one when it first came out. So, like, I'm into it. But I had this experience at lunch the other day, and I remember I sat down, I had my headphones on, I was just looking around the restaurant, and this is an average restaurant. Yes, I know it's in the Silicon Valley, so it does, you know, there is bias here, and it's one, the multiple, the plural of anecdote is not data, as they say, but this was my one anecdote. I'm sitting there and I look around and I counted like 7 Apple Watches in the store. And I remember the feeling of, you know, was the iPhone a success or not? Because it was a big question for quite a few years, because it was such a slow burn compared to these monumental giant companies out there. But what it really started to like, change for me was when, and this is like, I was early 20s, but it was like people my age were frequently having smartphones. And that's when I was like, okay, something has changed. Something's different. I think you're seeing some really weird, like, I think that the numbers we're seeing for the watches, once you graph it over 3 or 4 years, you'll look at this time and be like, yeah, there's just some weird cyclical things going on with the nature of Apple's releases, the fact that the Apple Watch is so dominant already, and Apple, whereas like with smartphones, there was much more of a regular, like the cycle was smoothed out by the fact that there were constantly new launches and new phones from different manufacturers.
The 2-year contract helped a little bit too.
That it was a huge, I think we look at the iPhone as some sort of the smartphone as some sort of an indicator of how this is supposed to be. And it's just so like, it's such an anomaly for so many reasons.
Why don't they do that? Like, I just don't understand. And I'm going to take a slightly off track here. Why don't they do like subsidized watches and computers and other stuff? I don't know. I don't get it.
I think the feeling is
I know it's called borrowing, but you could brand it slightly different and people would totally get into it.
I was going to say, I think what it is, honestly, is that it seems too obvious what they're doing with the phones. That the whole subsidy thing was like, because basically, you're just borrowing money and from the telephone company so you could get a better device, and they had these regular update cycles, which was good enough for them. They were making the money they wanted to make. But where they really loved it was when you didn't upgrade right away.
Cause oh, I know.
You kept paying the same rates that your subsidy was based on. And so now they're kind of gone to this new thing where it's like, nah, you just pay it until it's paid off. And it's becoming a little more transparent. But as it becomes more transparent, people are also starting to really understand that they're buying $1,000 phones on debt and paying it off like it were a car. It's crazy when you really like sit down. And when people start to understand what it is, it's not so obscuring your phone bill. I think it becomes kind of weird, and it's a more difficult sell with watches and tablets. I still think that this is honestly I've packed up the Google Home, and I already miss it because I miss talking to it. But I got to play
with an Echo yesterday, by the way.
Oh man,
pretty fun.
They're cool, but honestly, I still think if you could put all of the intelligence of the Google Home into a 3 or an LTE or even a 4G connected wristband device, like I'd be happy. I would not need a phone. I would need that and a tablet. The tablet would sit on my desk and stuff, and all of my notifications and all my, you know, for browsing, I'd have a small tablet. For work, I'd have a small tablet. That's what I use my phone for. But for just everything else my phone does, that like notifications, simple communication stuff. And I think that there's an entire universe of people that will want that once it's really there at a level that's doable, where you can manage the battery life, you can manage the how do you have data. But this idea that you don't need a phone, it blows my mind when people sit there and be like, no, the phone's like this like ideal functional size. That just feels so wrong to me. It's just, and I've talked about this before, and maybe I'm completely wrong, and I'm like, maybe. Nobody thinks like me, but I still think the phone is the worst possible size. It's too small to be really useful, like a big screen, and it's too big to be truly mobile, because you're constantly having to like deal with it in your pockets, and where does it go and stuff. It's not just always there, sort of omnipresent. And I think the real reason why the phone works so well in its form factor is because it's the battery size, the CPU size, the like everything just kind of goes together in this nice package at this form factor. And as batteries keep improving and we get smaller nanometer chips, so you need less power and less smaller form sizes, and all of these little things keep making improvements, you're going to find one day all the pieces are there for a watch that can really replace the phone. And then people will be like, well, this just seems like this just happened all of a sudden. Like Apple's original Apple Watch was so dumb and obviously it wouldn't work. But it was transitionary. What's wrong with you people? How can you not see
this?
Do you think
there'll be a combination with like a Magic Leap type of thing too? To enable that?
With a Magic Leap?
Yeah, some AR something or other. Because screen size will always still come up as an issue.
Well, yeah, I think that's part of it, is that we're going to live in a world like we...
And maybe that'll replace the watch. Just
say we live more and more in a world where you'll either have screens over your eyes or you'll have screens everywhere. Like, and that's the thing, is that it's this general purpose CPU that you take all over the place, and it means that you don't have to have computers everywhere. But that's the goal right now, is to put computers everywhere. That's what the entire silicon industry is trying to do, and they're succeeding slowly but surely. You know, that we have not even talked about Pebble or Fitbit, but this is hilarious. But the idea that these devices and where they're going, what are they? What are they capable of? To me, I just sit there and I go, the idea that you'll carry a screen around in your pocket everywhere will seem laughable in 30 years. Like, why would you do that? That's such a bad idea. It's such a useless, like, you're like typing with the tips of your fingers trying to carefully...
laugh about. Remember when screens used to crack and you get screwed?
Right? Yeah. Can you believe we used to do that? That's the only thing, is I could see. I like the idea of the watch because it doesn't obscure your vision constantly. And but people who need glasses to see well wear glasses all the time. So we might get to that point where instead of having screens everywhere,
AR to see well.
Exactly. You know, that's a legitimate alternative to us to the smartwatch being part of this, another step in this evolution of what we do. But I just, you know, and the thing is, it's like as the internals of these watches become more and more sophisticated and become easier and easier for other companies to reproduce, that's when it'll return as a fashion device. Because ultimately, they're general purpose CPUs. And like if you could afford 6 or 7 watches that all sort of do the bare minimum of communicating quickly with a server somewhere that does the heavy lifting of computation, then you really can have one kind of old expensive watch that sits around for 5 years. You know, it's like we think about our computers. How long does a computer last nowadays? 5 years? You know, these aren't unsolvable problems. What they require is very energy efficient, dedicated hardware in the form of, like, you know, watch. I don't know. And that's why it's funny, because it's like Pebble is just, they were too far ahead and too far behind at the same time. I think they were focused on the wrong things. You know, they wanted the 7-day battery, which just Apple's proven that wasn't the big, that's not what people really wanted. What people really wanted was a beautiful screen and as ridiculous and a high quality, like, motion or, health sensors. Like, that's something that Apple did. They got above the bar for very good in generation one, and then they took it to Fitbit in generation two. The idea that where the Apple Watch will succeed is when it succeeds as a health tracker, and then everything else is just going to be butter. That's what's going to set us apart and allow us to charge premiums. But the health tracking, GPS, high quality heart rate, can use it in the ocean.
Those customizable watch faces. Oh, dang.
Yeah, but those are the sorts of things where Android, I'm surprised. Well, Android, I think part of the deal with the Android manufacturers is they're all taking a step back and say, look, these are expensive experiments. Let's give it a few years and figure out where it's going. And then we can.
Didn't Samsung just announce that they're not refreshing their round or whatever they're calling it? Right? Was that Samsung or was that Motorola?
A Motorola just announced they're not doing theirs.
Because they had the big round one that everyone was like, this is the best looking one of the bunch. And now they're not refreshing it. which I think it's back to that. We're still checking it out.
Hey. Okay. Hold on 1 second. I'm getting a phone call, and I just got called twice, and I'm going to make sure that this isn't an emergency.
All right, you go on mute, and I'm going to double check it there. So while he's doing that, checking on his phone call, so like we talked about, Pebble's done. There's thing 7-day battery life. That was pretty amazing, and I think that their color e-ink screen, we're going to see that definitely come back with Fitbit. I have on my Apple Watch right now a watch face, which it's like, it's okay. I have ideas for it to be better. I don't have an option with it outside of like colors and stuff. I used to have some really, really creative watch faces that people would put together. Like the one I led the show off because it made me seem really geeky. It was a bar chart, and the left column was hours, so there was 4 bars or 12 bars. I can do math, and then the right column had 60 parts to it, and that was with the minutes, and so you could tell the time by reading the bar chart. You know, it was super nerdy. I had one that looked like the Star Trek Next Generation touch screen that's on the Enterprise, because why not? That looks kind of cool. I don't know. There was just a bunch of. You could do some really cool things with it, and I'm gonna miss that. It'll come back in some way, like you said. If I really missed it, I'd go Android, because that would probably allow me to do that. Is my guess.
I think it's one of those things where this is a
you're still early in it. I still think you're early in it, and I don't think it's wrong for. I think Fitbit made the right decision where they said, "Look, we think that there's a future."
They're taking the smarts though, not the products, right? Pebbles will no longer be sold. Their Kickstarter thing is returning all the money to them. They're not even continuing the support for current watches. I saw that and was like, oh man.
No.
It's tough.
And I think, yeah, which is a bummer if you've invested in
that. Dude, I know a guy, he when Fitbit came out with, or not this latest one, but the one before that, he bought two. And
Fitbit or Pebble?
Pebble. One for himself and then like one for his son, and his son was like, no, I don't want one. And so he was like, hey, you guys want a Pebble? I'll give it to you. Reasonable price. And which was not at a discount. It was what he paid for it. I was like, dude, you take a bet like that, you got to pay the price. And I was ultimately like, no, I'm holding out. I don't want that. I feel bad for him because he's like, he's a tech guy. He gets it. He's not a massive nerd or a maven, if you will. But I don't know. I feel bad.
I do. I feel bad too. And it's, you know, but it's one of those things where I think Fitbit is doing about as good as they can going toe to toe with Apple right now, where it's like, we got a brand, we got a community. We're going to keep focus on what our brand does, what our community does, leverage that into higher prices, try to make some good profit and set ourselves up for the next generation of devices. And, you know, keep just moving forward carefully and you know, quickly but carefully. And they bought a bunch for very cheap. They bought a bunch of expertise and intellectual property that, you know, can help
them. Yeah, that IP is going to be a big deal, I think.
Yeah.
Because they're going to continue to go the route of you don't need a full-blown watch. You just need a fitness tracker. They're going to go after that category.
Right.
You know, and they're going to say, and it's less than $250.
Yep. And it'll be a good space to be. You know, there's really nobody else right now that's there and is succeeding. And I think as a couple of the Android developers start to back out, it'll allow one or two to kind of step in and say, look, we get it. What you really want is a high quality fitness tracker with sophisticated notifications and maybe a little bit more, you know, customizable screen faces and stuff.
Makes you wonder where Apple intends to go with their next version of the watch. Because they clearly were like, okay, we're focused on fitness. And they'll obviously continue to make strides. And they'll be like, we're getting more accurate blood temperature, pressure, I don't know. You know, whatever. They're going to get more accurate at the health stuff as well. But do they then say, okay, we've conquered that, let's go focus on another area? Do they put the LTE in and go Apple Watch 3G?
Yeah. Like
they did with a certain telephonic computer, not a device, because it was a computer, let's be honest. And you know what I mean? I don't know. It just makes you wonder. Or do they triple down on the whole health tracker thing?
I think they've decided.
You think so?
I think that's it. I think that they're going to try. What they really, really want is something that's so sophisticated, it borderline requires FDA approval in order to be sold. Like, they want to get right up to that line and stay on the unregulated side of the FDA, but they want it to be that sophisticated of a health tracker. And because I think they have accurately decided, and I think they made that decision long before they started, you know, even before they finished their first generation of device. And that's something that, like, once again, we've been talking about, like, because I remember us talking like a year before the Apple Watch came out, where it became this sudden epiphany of, like, I realized this like coded language that they were talking about, that like, they're building a health tracker. That's what they're focusing on. That's what they want. And they kept hiring like health tracker people, the engineers who were into that for, you know, months and months and months, and then the original device came out, and it was kind of disappointing. All it was a heart rate monitor and a pedometer. Like, wow, that's it? That's all you did? You know, and this next generation is, well, and it's waterproof, and it's got GPS. well, okay, so the next generation has barometers, and it has a glucose detector, and it has a, you know, and you
can move, you detect glucose from your wrist?
Theoretically, but yeah, it's there's all sorts of different technologies that they can, that they're going to continue to work on, I think, to
truly... Yeah, it'd be interesting if you could, not just heart rate, but like blood pressure.
Yeah, that's another one that I believe that they think that you could do non-invasively. Hmm. So it's, you know, there's all sorts of stuff that they're trying to do, and I think that that's the big push on the devices.
Okay.
You know, is make it a health... It isn't like the Apple... Like the iPhone was a misnomer. It wasn't a phone. It was a computer with a phone app. I actually think that they look at the Apple Watch as a misnomer as well. It's not a watch. It's something else. And I think that something else is primarily a health tracker.
Yeah, I was going to say, but generally not... Or clearly not a general purpose computer.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, you got notifications and you can reply to them. And I use Siri on my watch all the time.
Yeah, I think that's the other big thing that's coming down the pipe. And is that this idea of a server side connection, something like as the Echo and Google Home continue to improve and build up and prove that that's a useful interface. Apple made an announcement this week. I'm going to jump around a little bit because it's apropos. Apple made an announcement this week that they're going to start allowing their employees to publish their AI research, which is a huge deal because they're currently the biggest company that has serious money being invested into AI research that doesn't publish. And it's been difficult for Apple. The belief is, the justification that Apple is making is like, look, it's good for the community. We learn from other people's research. You learn from our research. We're all going somewhere together. It's, you know, high tide raises all boats. Yeah, yeah. Obviously, the secretest of our secret sauce we're going to keep internal, but we're going to allow employees to publish research so that all of us can work together, which is very high-minded. The reality of it is that it's really individually beneficial to the individual developers totally. To be publishing. They want to publish because it helps raise their value over time, and so they can get paid more and everything. And everybody in the industry will let them do that except Apple. And so they're having a retention and hiring issue because people don't want to work for them because they'll come up with something brilliant and then somebody else will get the credit for it, developing it 6 months later. It's driving them nuts. So they're finally going to start allowing their employees to do that. But one of the big things that they're working on when it comes to artificial intelligence is this idea of, like, it's the same basic stuff that Google and Facebook and everybody else is working on, where it's like natural language comprehension and creation. They're working on, so like having it be able to understand somebody talking to it and having it be able to talk back in an articulate way. They're focused on doing all of their algorithms are optimized for GPUs, so graphical processing units, as opposed to the FPGAs that Microsoft is using or the dedicated hardware acceleration that Google's doing with TensorFlow. And GPUs are incredibly cheap because everybody buys the same one from NVIDIA. So there's a real cost advantage there. And they're doing cool stuff. I guess one of the things that they're doing is they'll create these really sophisticated neural networks and they'll train them for image processing, for example.
I heard about this. Yeah.
They were talking about how their image set is like twice the size as everybody else's. So they get these really, really remarkably great results from this giant neural network. But the problem with the neural network is that it's gigantic. So what they do is they then have that neural network create specific inputs and outputs to train a dedicated GPU based neural network that's lighter weight, and it will create the inputs and outputs for that quote unquote, they call it they're calling it the little brother, the sibling network. And basically it's all of the inputs and outputs are optimized to tune the network really, really quickly and specifically so that what you end up with is this very lightweight neural network that is as effective at classifying as the parent one.
And if I remember correctly, like, help me if this sounds way too simplistic, but it was like essentially the little brother neural network's only job is to guess what the big brother network would say it is.
That's exactly
so
what
it is. So it doesn't have to do the processing. It just goes, I think it would be this one.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
And, like, so and it's close enough.
Well, yeah, because you know, if we talk about pattern finding stuff, it's like basically
so it, just, it reduces, it takes out all the noise, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. And gotcha. Makes them run super efficient. So they were like bragging about how like they can go through photos twice as fast as Google can.
Well, how come their image search is garbage,
though? I don't know why. This is what was so amazing to me reading all this. I was just like, why is all their stuff so bad right now then? Like, I mean,
it's like you wouldn't have to publish if you just made the product.
I know. I don't understand what is going on with them right now. And I think, I honestly think I do understand. It's the fact that the best of the best will build something great at Apple and go, you know what? I don't get any credit for this. This doesn't help me in my career. And they leave. And so Apple does have some really amazing stuff that are, but they have a small
shelf.
Yeah. And they have a small team who's not really doing anything right now and who's not building. And so this is part of their whole, we got to turn around. We got to change this department because this is too freaking important. And, you know, because one of their big things is they want to be able to run these neural networks on the phones and on the watches and do the language processing and do a lot of
privacy concerns. They want it all on the device. And it's faster.
And it's a lot faster, and they can do that, but it requires quite a bit of effort. And I don't know, it's really interesting what they're kind of some of the stuff they were talking about that they're doing and how good they are at doing it, especially when you look at like Apple and Facebook and the people that are way better, right? And they're seemingly way better. And I don't know. The one that still confuses me to this day is why is Siri so much better on my watch than it is on my phone? Like, I don't understand that. That is an incomprehensible idea to me.
So. Yeah, you know, it's funny. Now that I have a watch, I don't know, like, what would I use an Echo or Google Home for?
The only advantage to it is I really liked to be able to just be, it stayed in my room so other people could use it, which was nice other to control people. Things in my room. Okay. That was a huge advantage. And the other one was that the whole always listening thing, like, I don't know. It's just, it was a little bit, my watch isn't great at always listening. Hey, Siri. Oh, actually, wow. That was okay. That was a bad example. It did a really good job that time.
Well, that's what I find. For me, it almost always gets it. So like I use the timer like all the time, like when we put our kid or dog on timeout, and yes, we put them both in timeout. When I get done, I'll just as I'm walking away, you know, I'll say the magic word and set a timer for a minute or two, and you know, works great. I use it to. What did I have the other day? I was like leaving the kitchen, and I had my hands were full, and I almost was like, oh, I should set this down and turn the light off. I was like, what am I doing? What a noob. And, just real quick, hey, Siri, turn off the kitchen lights. Boom, done. I use it for all of those, like, tiny little tasks. I wish that it would connect to my Apple TV so I could tell it to play a certain app. Doesn't do it.
Yeah.
That would be super convenient, just putting it out there. Which I understand that Google can do that if you have a Chromecast. But
Yes, that's true. I had the weirdest experience this week. I walked into my room. I still had the Google Home set up, so I was still using it to control my lights and everything. And I walked in, and I flipped the light switch in my room, which doesn't feel like that should be that big of a deal, except all of my outlets are attached to this light switch. So all of my phone, my PlayStation, my Google Home, my lights, like everything, just instantly powered off. Like I just cut the power. I was like, I haven't hit that light switch in like 4 years. What just happened in my brain that I did that? Like,
wow.
I did it like I've been doing it every day. It was so weird.
So question on that one. Are those all in a, is your outlet, is it just one of the outlets turns off and on with the light switch, or is it both?
I got two outlets in both the top. I got two actual physical, like, separate outlets on two walls, and then each one of them are a single gang, so they got the two outlets. Both outlets on the one that everything's plugged into turn off when you hit the light switch.
Both outlets on the okay, so there's two holes, right? I get single right. gang.
There's two plugs. There's two plugs on this one. Both plugs turn off.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Usually it's just one of the two outlet holes. Never mind.
I know. I know. Drives me weird. Crazy.
I mean, you know the other way you can get around it, which you're a renter, so you probably shouldn't. But you just go into your light switch and you can make a quick change. Put a plate there instead. You're done. Interesting. Okay. Yeah, so anyways, Pebble's done. Apple's doing some AI stuff to try to stay ahead. It sounds interesting. They should just come up with some products. Just do it.
Speaking of right? Come on, Apple. Speaking of artificial intelligence, so Amazon...
Big creepy maybe, brother.
I know. Amazon did something kind of cool this week.
They oh, I love Amazon.
Store. I know. They announced a new store that is... It's on their campus in Seattle. It's currently open only to Amazoners, people who work for the company.
Is that what they call themselves?
Their namesake? No, I don't think so.
Okay, good.
Amazonians.
Probably call themselves a tribe or something.
Yeah, right. Yeah. The team.
The Bezheads.
The Bezheads. Yeah, but it will be opening up to the public later at some point.
Next year, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, but this is the basic idea. You have a phone app that is, you know, like connected to your Amazon app, and you open it up, and it's got like a little QR code on the screen. You walk into the store, and as you walk through the turnstiles, you scan the app, and so it connects to you. And then you walk around the store, you pick stuff off the shelves and whatnot, you put it in your bag or you take it in your hand, doesn't matter. You walk out of the store with it, and then your Amazon account gets charged for everything that you picked up. And if you're sitting there saying, wait, but how does it know? What if I picked it up and put it back down? What if somebody else picks it up? Like how does it know? And the answer is artificial intelligence and a whole machine vision and a whole slew of other sensor technologies. Basically, they got cameras everywhere watching everything all the time, and they're constantly tracking you and where you are. And then they've got sensors in the shelves, it sounds like, that maybe, maybe not, kind of depends on where you're grabbing. But they're able to sense how much of what you're picking up. And they know that you're there grabbing it because it's you. They can watch you with their machine vision stuff. And then so when something gets picked up, it sees that you picked it up, and then... it just adds it to your list, and then you you walk out. Bada bing, bada boom. Cashierless. It's like self-checkout on steroids. I was listening to a Freakonomics podcast, and they had an episode on the guy who invented the original self-checkout machine. And they were talking about complaints of self-checkout and how some people like it. I like it. I'm a big fan. I always take it if I can get it. Other people hate it because it's like, it's difficult. It doesn't work that well. It's, you know, and there's all sorts of stupid stuff that people are making that the government is ruining it, especially in California. You can't buy alcohol at it. So you're like, you'll get up there, you'll try to ski, you'll have like a six pack and it'll tell you, oh, sorry, you can't buy that. You're like, you got to be kidding me. And then, like, once you get to get out of line, go into the other line, or you'll I'll ask you if you want bags, since we don't have bags in California anymore. And it's just like, why are you making this so difficult on me? And they're ruining the experience again, because all of a sudden it went from being this very, very fast, it was the fastest way to get out of the store, to, especially if you kind of know what you're doing, to it's like they're slowing it down with a bunch of interactions with other people. But this podcast, Freakonomics podcast, they pointed out that there is an example of self-checkout working really, really great, and everybody loves it. It's the best. And that example is Amazon. And how that's when you're on Amazon.com, it's effectively self-checkout because all of your information is already tagged up and tabulated. You basically just put the stuff in your cart and then you click, okay, cool. And then you're done. It's that easy. And they're like, this is obviously what they're just trying to make that same feat in the real world. And to make it that convenient to buy things, that everything is like that. And the crazy part about it is that, like, that's where we are from a technology perspective. Like, all the things that Tesla and Google and all these companies are doing to try to make self-driving cars that keep track of stuff and understand what it is and where it is in real time, that's the same sort of technology that they're using, that Amazon's using here. The only difference is it's a can you manage to steal from them? That's the big question. And that's the worst thing that can happen to them, as opposed to, you know, Google or Tesla, where people die if they mess up. So it's a little bit of a lower bar for danger, so they can be a little more aggressive on saying, yeah, you know what? There's a certain amount of loss prevention that happens in every store. People lose, you know, people steal all the time. And, you know, it's like 10% of, like, a store. They look at, like, 10% is all going to be losses. And Amazon sitting there saying, hey, if we can keep it at that level, we just know where to set our prices, or we figure out what our loss rate is, we set the prices at that amount, and then you just go from there. That's how all stores deal with it. And the question is, can you keep your prices low enough to still be advantageous? Oh, also, you don't have to hire anybody.
What'll be interesting is, and you know this is eventually coming, where they'll essentially have, they'll start to have an idea of when things disappear or get stolen, because I mean, it's hard, it's going to be, I don't know, it's going to be interesting, right? Because it's all camera based, so in theory, when it's no longer on the shelf, they'll know about it,
right?
You know, and at the very least, like, they'll be able to tell at the end of the day how much they lost,
right?
And they will know every single person who went into that store that day, right? And it might take a while. But if you're a habitual thief,
yeah, like,
they could pin you down, right? And go, holy cow, every time this guy comes, something gets stolen. The numbers might be too big, too broad. It will work a lot more effectively if they'll know within the hour, because then they will really shrink down the sample set for that time. But it, in theory, could get to a point where they go, you know what? You're just too much of a security risk. We're good.
Yeah,
so, or well, just extra trained cameras on this one.
I was going to say, well, and that's the weird part, right? Is it's like, you know, you talk about stealing, but, like, how do you steal? Because, like you said, it knows when something gets picked up off the cart. So the only way to steal is to basically have it not know it was you. And
somehow
how
think
you do that.
Put it back. That would be my, like, that's how like magicians stand a chance at this.
Oh, you do like a little, what's it called?
Sleight of hand?
Temple of the Lost Ark? No.
Oh, yes. You got your bag of sand?
Yeah, exactly.
Got your empty box you trade it with?
Exactly. And then one of the things that I know that works pretty effectively on obscuring facial tracking, actually, is they'll build these hats that you put little LEDs on them, infrared LEDs, and basically makes your face this, like, this flashlight.
Yeah, but again, like, they're going to know about that.
Right? I know. That's the
and
thing.
And they'll know. I mean, here's the thing, right? Like, it knows everybody who is in the store. So if you're that one person wearing it, guess what? It knows who you are.
Right, exactly. Well, and it's one of those things where it's like that. Yeah, it's, you'd have to do it on your whole body because it's not like it will probably.
And you'd have to have that hat off and then turn it on once you're inside the store. Because even if you're just like the glow of the face, the second you swipe your phone, like, okay, it's tracking the glow of the face. I don't know.
Right. Well, it'll track your whole body.
It's got the back of your head. It's got.
It'll know.
I bet you find that it's super hard to steal from that store. Though, yeah. It will be an interesting challenge, too.
Yeah, I was going to say, now I want to try, though.
Dude, you know they've set that out, right? Like, dude, try to steal from us. We'll give you a prize if you can.
Well, and that's the thing. And honestly, just so, you know, think about this as a, and I can understand what they're trying to do here, because the whole idea is,
if you the rumor, it, you could have it.
The rumor was that Amazon wanted to create like a giant chain of like stores. That was early in the week was. Amazon came back and were like, an emphatic no, that's not what we're trying to do. We're absolutely not trying to do that. Which everybody was like, okay, they're keeping it a secret, guys. But even if they're not, even if they're just trying to prove this technology, it totally makes sense as a highly valuable technology, because it does two things. Number one, yes, the cost is you got to put a bunch of cameras and computers in every single grocery store. Like, there's going to be setup and work take involved in doing that. But the really the big advantage here is, A, there's no cashiers, and cashiers cost money, and you know, which is, and cashiers are tend to be quite well paid and have benefits, and they've got unions. Like, there's a big cost savings if you can get rid of the need for cashiers. But the other
the margins in grocery stores are not huge. So if you can even just cut 10% of the jobs, cool.
Well, and how great would it be if you could reduce losses from
that's
fees
huge. That from, is worth it.
From 10% down to 2%, you know?
Yeah, and that means you can actually have more people on the floor helping customers and keeping things stocked and keeping it clean, which adds more value to it. I mean, I don't know about you, but like, I have this problem with Home Depot. Like, and my big issue is I like to go shopping at like 7:30, 8 o'clock at night. So they close at 9. I get that I'm not setting myself up for success here. It's a very different story at 6 in the morning, because you walk in, there's like no people, and there's like literally people in orange aprons standing in every single aisle, just chomping at the bit to help you, which is fantastic. Right. Which is when I should do my shopping, apparently. But anyways, I go at night, and I'm like, dude, I'll walk aisle after aisle and not see a single person there to help me. Like, this is annoying. Or like last night, I was looking up some plumbing stuff, and the guy was like, I don't know, I'm not the plumber, but here we are. Let's go look. I'm like, well, great. I could do that.
Yeah.
I appreciate the honesty, but it's not actually helpful. And, but anyways, you can have more people like that, which would actually help the customer experience.
Yeah. And I think you could see why Amazon would want to be in on this, why they'd sit there and go, this is good technology. Because if we can sell this package, that's good money.
Yeah.
If we can start these stores, that's good money. If we can, what we want to be is the, you know, we want to make this super convenient. And Walmart, you're on notice. You know,
Yeah, actually, that's the trick. Like, how well does this thing scale? Okay, I can do a small grocery store.
Yeah.
Can you do a superstore? Can it track all of that? Which, the answer is probably yes, but like, how well? Obviously, you can brute force it, but how well does it scale would be an important question that they're trying to answer, and they're answering it by like actually physically doing it, which is cool.
Yeah, it is really cool, and it's a neat little computer.
Man, so much for the end of brick and mortar, huh?
I know, right?
These guys, you just like they have this love hate relationship with brick and mortar.
Destroy all bookstores. Open up bookstores. What are you doing?
Well, it's like, here, we've got the Echo. Just order. Literally say, I want diapers, and they'll show up. But
like, yeah, well, you know, it's funny you talk about like, this is at the risk of getting too political. The new. Oh man, what is he? The guy who was the CEO of Hardee's in Carl's Jr.'s. He just got hired at Trump, Carl's Jr. I got this. I can.
Okay.
Let's. What's his name?
I can help you.
Trump's pick for Secretary of Labor.
Labor.
Okay, that's if we could really give me his name, that would really help.
Name.
Oh my gosh. Okay. I hate you, The Atlantic.
What are you going to say about him?
It's so annoying. Anyway, but he's like, one of his big things is he's opposed to a high minimum wage, and which of course, you know, the left hates him for, because, you know, that was a big platform point for them, was that, no, we want to go with the $15 minimum.
Husder, wage. Does that sound familiar?
That does sound familiar. But his
Andrew
whole deal,
Husder?
There we go. And his whole deal as the leader of Hardy/Carl's Jr. was like, look, if you make it too expensive to have these people, we just won't have these people. We'll just replace it with automation. And it's like, when you start to put...
Was that him? I thought it was a former CEO of McDonald's who, like...
He said it too. Okay. Like, they're all on the same page. They're like, look, we're very much coming up on the tipping point where it is cheaper to have these automation technologies for that part than it is for the customer interface than it is to have... you know, actual people there. And you think about, like, how cool would it be to be able to go into McDonald's? Like, okay, just hear me out here. You walk into McDonald's, you walk up to the screen or whatever, and you're like, yo, I want a burger. And then you walk over to just a thing full of French fries. You pick out as many French fries as you want, and then you walk over, you sit down, and then, like, a drone flies over and drops your Whopper at your table. And Whopper. they just yes. have. I didn't even realize I did that. it comes with a bit of a tax. it's one of those things where it's like you could just imagine this like world where it's like, no, you just kind of, we just know how much you've gotten, and if you want anything specific, you tell us. You tell our computer sensor, and it's all good. You know, we'll work that out, and now we don't need anybody to be.
It's like it's like the A&W where you sit down, and you get the little button that you push. I want this. You just tell it, and then it comes to you.
Exactly, okay. And it's like, imagine chips at like a Mexican restaurant where you order, and then they have like the little chip bar.
That was always my hope with the Microsoft Surface, is that it would be helpful with chips when you ran out, you would just like tap more chips, and they would just show up.
Yeah, that'd be great. But
I hate when I run out of chips.
I know, but that's why I love those stores with the chip, like Mexican restaurants with the chip bar was the best, because like they just have a whole tub of chips, and you get out as many chips as you want, and you like normally they have like tiny little containers that can hold like four chips in them, and so you go back a lot, but you can go back as much as you want, which is why I like it. And yeah, you could just see them being able to just keep track of that, be like, and they'll just tell you, oh yeah, you spent this much money. There's this tap room in Santa Cruz where you have like a wristband, and they literally just have like 100 different beers. Not 100. It's probably close to like 30.
approximately close enough.
A bunch. I rounded up.
Now you're on way down, but anyways,
but you get a glass, and you walk up, and you have like they give you a little wristband, and it just has a little RFID in it. And then it says, oh cool. It keeps track of how many ounces you've poured. Cause after you've poured like 36 ounces, you walk back up to the front and you go, hey, can I get 36 more ounces? And the dude goes, yeah, you're still sober, so you can go get some more. And then just now imagine this is a bar. You walk into the bar and it just, it knows you're 21 because of your beard, and it keeps track of you and who you are and where you are. So you just walk up to the bar, pour as much beer as you want. It'll have like a little indicator next to it that says, yeah, this is how much beer you had. This is how much money you've spent. And, you know, like, but there's no other like interaction involved, and
some people would argue that's a loss, not a gain.
Yes, yeah, because I know we all like waiting on a bartender late at night. That's the best part of going to a bar.
Maybe like a restaurant or something, not necessarily a bar. But
well, I've always thought with a restaurant that you'll never get rid of everybody, not because you can't, but because, like you said, there is that personal touch where I think what you really want is two maitre d's. that walk the floor and just have conversations. Their whole thing is just guest relations. Whereas, like you said, you've got a table that has sensors in the chip basket and in your soda glass and everywhere. So, like, they know when you're out of soda. They know when you're out of chips. And just, and there's somebody in the back who runs out, and all the automatically made food, they run out and they drop it off. And the maitre d's job is just to walk around and say, hey,
level 11.
Yeah, exactly. And the maitre d's job is just to walk around and be like, hey, I hope everything's going great tonight. Is there anything extra I can do for you? And yeah,
how are those chips?
Yeah, exactly. Are they perfect? You know, and I just think that, I think, yeah, like you said, some people will call that a loss, and you'll figure out how many people you need to have. Well, that's,
but those people are probably not at McDonald's or wherever, and you'll have different types of restaurants.
Exactly. And for me, when it comes to a bar, I either want to be alone and angry and sad and drunk, or I want to be just have as much beer as possible.
And I think when shopping, I would much rather have less cashiers and get them out on the floor.
Right.
Answer questions.
Yeah.
And do things like that. That to me is like totally better experience. Even if you have the same people, that's okay with me. Or you get rid of all your cashiers and you hire one or two experts or something.
Yeah.
And like actually know what they're talking about when it comes to plumbing. I'm not bitter at all that I have to go back again to talk to someone who knows what they're talking about. That's costing me time and money. That was super annoying. So right now I have a shower with the PEX pipe that goes to nothing. It's just hanging out there. Because I don't have the right. So how about this for weird? I'm just gonna like just give me 30 seconds, okay, 2 minutes here to just rant for a little bit. All right. So I bought this little elbow thing that you screw the elbow into a scab piece of wood, kind of in between to whatever. So your shower head, right? It's got the little bar that goes into the wall into a 90-degree elbow that then is connected to a pipe. Well, I have one of those. It's a shark bite, goes to PEX pipe thing. And then I was going to connect my shower elbow, the part that actually comes out, to this 90-degree, it's not a coupling. They call it a drop elbow. Anyways, they're both half inch. I'm at home. I go to, thread it on, to check it. Does not thread on. Excellent. Great. So I go to the store and they're like, well, they must be different thread types. Like, oh, okay.
I didn't know that was possible. Thanks.
Apparently that's the thing. Great. He goes, yeah, there's like three different types of thread things. Like, oh, well, I knew there was rough and fine, but okay, whatever. So we're trying to find the right one. Can't find it. Here's the crazy part. I grab a piece of galvanized pipe that has male and female on both sides of it. The galvanized pipe screws into my 90-degree elbow, and I can screw my shower head onto it. What? Mind blown!
All right.
I'm going, okay, I'm at a loss now. And tried multiple elbows, multiple shower heads. There's something about it. They don't line up, but somehow the way they make galvanized, it's all good. Works with everything. And then I didn't have a galvanized elbow that would screw into the wall, because you have to screw it into something, otherwise it moves around, and that's a problem. You, in theory, could just get a little strappy and put it on there, but they still, I don't know, I just super annoying. And the guy who was helping me was like, I don't know, that's weird, huh? Like, sure.
Okay. Yeah, that's like, frustrating.
There are multiple solutions to this. I just don't know where to look. And anyways, it was like 8:30 at night, and I was tired, and we still didn't have water on at our house, so I went home. Rant over.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I'll tell you what. I have got a dinner appointment that I have to go to, and probably...
Holy cow.
Yeah. We're right up against it, so I'd say we do one more story.
Okay, I'm interested in yours.
All right, cool. So,
mine, just real quick, we'll have a video of, it's a century-old technology used to make gas-powered engines more efficient. It's a cool video. It's essentially, it was this this concept that was from really, really long ago, but they didn't have the technology or the computer processing to make it happen. And now they do. And they're going to start putting it into vehicles. It makes them like 30% more efficient. It's awesome. Whoa. Check it out. Love the article. Furtherbros.com/272. Your turn.
So, thank you. So, yeah. So, there's a VR party starting. Pretty exciting.
Okay.
There's an organization that is being formed. It's called the Global VR Association. It is being joined by the likes of Google, HTC, Oculus, and Sony. And if you're thinking, hey, that's just about everybody that's a big deal in VR right now, you're right. And the whole purpose of this organization is to facilitate communication amongst the people who join it so that they can help start to build standards. There are two notable groups that are not involved in this organization yet. One is Valve, who I keep talking about as like they want to be the operating system of virtual reality. They own a bunch of the intellectual property that HTC's devices works on. They do all the software for it up to this point. They've now extended their software to work with Razer's Open VR thing. They're working with the Oculus right now. They're trying real hard to push the limits of what, you know, push the boundaries, work with more systems. And then the other deal is, the other big one that's not in it is Microsoft. And they've obviously got their whole AR initiative.
Yeah, it's a little bit.
And their VR stuff. Yeah, but the big idea here, and we've talked about this, and this is kind of what everybody wants, is for, well, what they ultimately, the goal, the hope is that VR headsets become sort of like monitors, where they all have, they all need, like, they got 6 degrees of freedom, right? So you got your different rotations, and then your forward, backwards, left, right, up, down. So spatial tracking and rotational tracking. And how the device achieves that, whether it's doing it with cameras built into it, or if it's got the sensors, the light sensors like HTC, or if it's got cameras like Sony and Oculus, it doesn't really matter. What is important is knowing where the helmet is, the headset is in space.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other piece of it is obviously output. Putting the, you know, how do we create a standardized video output that all these kind of work on, so that one piece of software can work with these different hardwares. And definitely have that feeling right now that we're at the point where it's time to start to coalesce and work towards standards. And yeah, everybody getting together and doing that. It's cool. Pretty exciting. I know. It's huge. It's awesome. It's very good news. I think honestly the reason why they're doing this right now is because they're looking at Microsoft and thinking, oh, that company could definitely come in like a wrecking ball and just set standards. And we would have no choice but to do what they're doing. So this is the European Union coming against the Americas, and trying to put together enough alliances where they have some sort of a collective sway against anything that Microsoft does that they collectively object to. I think that that's what this is all about. And Valve, the reason why they're not getting involved yet is because they're like, it doesn't really affect us yet. We're sort of doing this anyways. We'll see you on the other side, guys. Yeah, it's definitely, as we're moving forward and it's becoming an industry, people are really getting excited and kind of accepting that this is going to go somewhere. We'll start to see the end result of all this tech relatively quickly.
Oh, it's exciting.
I know. I love it.
I love it too. Awesome. All right. That's what we got for you.
Yes.
So next week, we'll talk more Star Wars, of course, and other tech stuff. And we're going to go from there. So everybody, gracias. Thank you for joining us. We really do appreciate it. And let's see, this is episode 272, so check out all the show notes there. If you'd like to get all the show notes sent directly to you, you can sign up at that same page. And we're doing a giveaway this week. We're giving away a Google Home. Matthew's reviewed it. We'll have that video in furlerbros.com/272. Plus, you can go to furlerbros.com/giveaways/Google Home. I have a link to that as well. All you got to do is give us your email address, and it could be yours. And if you share it, you get more votes. And yeah, it's awesome. So thanks for listening. And let's see here. I am James Furlow and my stargazing brother for another rotation around the sun is Matthew Furlow. And we will talk next time. Thank you.